Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello everyone, I am Nick Peters, and you are listening to the Deeper Waters podcast. We were going to have Jeff Harshberger come on and talk about the occult. I told you there could be some difficulties where those difficulties came through, and I'm sure he'd love to be here, and sometime we are going to work on getting him here. But in the meantime, I wanted to bring a friend on here, because while we at Deeper Waters have been wanting to get the best scholarship out there, I also want to highlight people who I think are up-and-coming scholars. And when I say friend, in this case, I most definitively mean friend. My guest here today is Chris Winchester. Chris, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. Well, since I've defined you as a friend, maybe we should tell the audience about how it is you and I know each other.
That sounds like a good idea to me.
Okay. Now, when I went to Charlotte to go to seminary, and I had a good friend come with me who's in the Bible college program there now, I was in class one time, and I was told about someone else who does internet apologetics, and that turned out to be you, didn't it? Wasn't it?
That's correct.
And we've been friends ever since then. In fact, the friend that's in the Bible college program right now, we kind of became our partners in crime, as it were. If several nights we've spent at our apartment, for instance, playing Smash Brothers together and watching movies, and of course, you and I went through the final season of Smallville together.
That's right. We both traveled down the path of righteousness.
Mm-hmm. And of course, when we went for that final season, normally it'd been just you and I, but for the final season, for a good part of it, it wasn't just you and I, because when the final season started, somehow I'd gone and gotten myself hitched.
That's right.
And in fact, you're such a good friend, you were one of my groomsmen at the wedding.
I sure was. It was a very good ceremony, too.
Thank you for not passing out. And in fact, our other partner in crime, who I understand is listening today since he'd heard some doofus was going to be on the air, as my guest, he was my best man. So we've known each other for some time. What is it that you're doing now, Chris?
Well, right now I'm just enjoying being back in America, visiting with friends and family. But throughout the school year, I'm actually overseas pursuing a doctorate in New Testament language and literature over in Scotland.
Yeah, I'm trying to tell them they can keep you if they want to, but they're not listening too much. What's your degree going to be in again?
It's the official title is Doctorate of Philosophy in New Testament Language and Literature.
Now, I've noticed from you that you've also spent a lot of time dealing with mythicists. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. For my audience who might not know, what exactly is a mythicist?
That is a great question. Basically, a mythicist is essentially somebody who says Jesus Christ did not even exist as a real person on planet Earth. Now, beyond that basic definition, you will probably receive different definitions. because there are different types of mythicists. There are some mythicists who really rely on showing quote-unquote parallels between Jesus and the Egyptian god Horus. There are other mythicists who I actually consider to be more academic mythicists who will openly acknowledge that actually the parallels between Jesus and Horus aren't really there. That if they really look at the ancient sources and look at the quote-unquote evidence, they realize they really don't have anything to stand on. And the more academic mythicist I'm referring to basically comes down to Richard Carrier and Earl Doherty. And we'll be discussing, I think, Carrier's specific brand of mythicism pretty soon. And the reason why I like to focus on him is because he really does try to sort through all the bad forms of mythicism, and he presents the strongest case, as he says, for mythicism.
Of course, his case is very largely influenced by Doherty, so we're probably having some interaction with him. Now, to be sure, the mythicist position isn't anything, for instance, like many New Testament scholars who would say, yeah, Jesus lived, but he wasn't the Son of God, he didn't do miracles, he didn't rise from the dead. That's not mythicism, right?
That's correct. And in fact, Carrier and basically any mythicist you speak with online, I would think, would even tell you that they are, in fact, a fringe position that the majority of scholars today agree Jesus did exist. And, I mean, I've been through about 9 years now of life in universities, and I can tell you from my personal experience that most professors are not evangelical Christians with an agenda to prove that Jesus existed. They're, in fact, a lot of them would be very loosely defined as Christians. I mean, one of them in particular denies the resurrection, and yet he considers himself to be a Christian.
Yeah, but this is all at Christian universities, right?
Oh, no. Well, I mean, unless you define the University of North Carolina at Charlotte or the University of Edinburgh as Christian universities, I would say no.
Now, when we listen to internet atheists, they seem to treat this as if the existence of Jesus is really an open debate in New Testament studies. That's not really the case, though, is it?
Not really. The debate's not so much, did Jesus exist? It's more of, what kind of Jewish man was he?
Yeah. Now, also from what I've seen, that most New Testament scholars, and when they're writing their books, the Jesus myth position, it's lucky if it even gets a footnote.
That is correct. Although, there seems to be a trend now that's including New Testament scholars joining in the debate a little bit. I mean, most recently, Bart Ehrman released his book, Did Jesus Exist, last year, and it really upset the apple cart, you could say, among the mythicist camp on the internet. And other professors, including Morris Casey and some people from Duke, have actually engaged the mythicists as well. And next year, Morris Casey is coming out with a pretty, I think, extensive book responding to mythicism. But it's still, as I said, it's a very fringe position, but it's getting to the point now where scholars in the field are trying to deal with it before it gets out of hand.
Why do you think this position is so prominent amongst internet atheists, then?
Well, I think on the internet, as your guest last week said, a lot of the bad ideas that were discredited among scholars centuries ago seem to just stick around. And in the internet, anybody can post anything and become amateur scholars, you could say. And so the Christ myth idea is basically an example of this discredited theories within scholarly circles.
You know, something I've written about before also is that it seems that many atheists have what I refer to as a Jesus allergy, where they're be willing to do anything just to not admit that there is anything true whatsoever in the Bible. And it's a hyper-skepticism that won't allow for any real evidence, since everything in the New Testament is from biased religious kooks.
Right. And I do think there's a lot of emotion wrapped up in it. I haven't fully figured out why that is the case, but I know that when you get down to the very roots of their objections and you kind of peel through their arguments, mm-hmm. a lot of times, I mean, myself personally have been met with a lot of hostility and emotionalism.
Mm-hmm. Now, another scholar who takes this position that Jesus never existed in New Testament studies is Robert Price as well, right?
Correct. Yes.
But he's not really as well known amongst internet atheists as Richard Carrier is.
Probably not as well known, but he's pretty up there.
Yeah.
I get him quoted to me a lot.
That Richard Carrier is kind of the new up-and-coming person that everyone wants to point to. Now, some of my listeners might not know who Carrier is, so tell us a bit about who Richard Carrier is.
Richard Carrier is a very eminent atheist, and he's been very active on the Internet Infidels website for years, and a lot of his books that are coming out now are revisions of some of his online papers. And I will compliment him on two major points. The first is he has a doctorate in ancient history, so he is aware of how historians generally engage in their discipline. And second, he's a very, very skilled debater. So he's a good person to, I wouldn't say debate with, but I would say just dialogue with as a conversation partner to understand the cutting edge of mythicism.
And you've had your own dialogues with him, not anything like a real in-person formal debate, but you've had your dialogues, haven't you?
We have exchanged emails over the past 2 or 3 years, I believe, and they weren't even debates. They're more along the lines of me asking him questions. I read some of the things he's written. I just asked for clarification. And earlier this past year, though, I did have a question based on what we're going to talk about partly today, and got into a little miniature debate on his blog.
Now, there could be some mythicists who are listening in, or people who have questions about mythicists, or even about Carrier. I'm going to go ahead and give out the phone number for the first time here. If you all want to call in and ask a question on the topic of the existence of Jesus today, it's 714-242-5180. Okay, so we're talking about how we're going to deal with a mythicist position. So, Chris, what's the best way for us to begin?
As far as if somebody approaches you with the arguments?
Yes.
I would say really, really dig into the ancient sources. I would recommend that people read, say, the works of Flavius Josephus, a first-century Jewish historian. I think they need to read the works of Philo of Alexandria, who was another first-century Jew. They need to be very, very familiar with the Hebrew Bible and the Dead Sea Scrolls, which you can actually get pretty cheap now as a soft cover book from Barnes & Noble, I believe. And I recommend people read the New Testament for themselves.
Right.
And realize that just because they read a book or read a web page or hear a broadcast or see a TV program, it doesn't mean that what all those sources are saying is true.
Right.
And lastly, I recommend people get dictionaries called lexicons that basically explain ancient words' meanings. So, for example, we have Greek lexicons. And this doesn't mean I think everyone needs to go and learn ancient languages. I think if you just get a lexicon, you can look up a word and you see the definition. And if you can do that, I think it really clears up some confusion.
In fact, everything you've said, it also applies to yourself. I mean, you're going to be giving a lot of information on this podcast, and you're not wanting everyone to just go out and say, this is all gospel right now, but go and investigate it and see what you think.
Absolutely.
So, how does Carrier come to his mythicist position?
Well, he actually used to debate mythicists himself, and he would interact with them and just say these are just logically fallacious arguments. But eventually, other atheists started directing him to the work of Orla Doherty and his book called The Jesus Puzzle, which is now a revised book called Jesus, Neither God Nor Man. And after Carrier read his work, he concluded that, yes, there were problems with what Doherty was saying in parts of the book, but overall, he thought he made the most compelling case for the non-existence of Jesus. And so he's kind of followed him a little bit, and he's also kind of slightly added elements to his specific case.
Okay. A lot of my listeners might not know about Doherty. Can you tell us a bit about him?
Yes. He is a very, very well-known internet mythicist. He has a website called The Jesus Puzzle. And he's basically been saying Jesus never existed at all for at least a decade, I believe. And his basic argument is the earliest Christians, such as the Apostle Paul, believed Jesus was just a spiritual creature in the heavenly realms, and that this being was crucified, died, and was buried in the lowest level of heaven, which is the area just below the moon, and that eventually he rose from the dead in that realm and ascended back to the highest layer of heavens.
Okay.
And then later, as the Gospels were being written, the celestial Jesus was kind of humanized. He was put on earth within a historical setting. And Richard Carrier, his main thesis is that Jesus was this type of being, and that Paul hallucinated conversations with the celestial deity, along with other early Christians.
Now, does Doherty have any real credentials in the field?
He does have a bachelor's, I believe, in classics, and he knows Greek, and I believe that's about it. He tried to go into graduate work, but due to medical reasons, which he has not disclosed, he wasn't able to complete it. But he's basically just been engaging in internet writing, and obviously the two books I mentioned.
But by and large, the scholarly world doesn't really take him seriously, do they?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Now, Carrier, I understand, also came to this position because he was given some pay. He was wanting to get through his schooling, I think, and he was told, I'll write on whatever topic you all want me to write about if you offer me financial help. Am I correct with that?
Yes. A lot of his fans online basically said, we'd be willing to give you, as it were, a research grant to write about the existence or non-existence of Jesus. And he graciously accepted the offer, and he has just finished the book. It's actually either under peer review or has just finished peer review, scheduled to be released later this fall.
In this book, I understand it's called Proving History, right?
No. Proving History is currently available for purchase. It's part one in his two-part series. The second book that's about to come out is called On the Historicity of Jesus Christ.
Okay. Well, our call-in number for anyone who's interested in calling in is 714-242-5180. What we're going to do now, before we get into the real meat of the argument that Carrier has, we're just going to take a break, and we'll be back to discuss this matter further.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite rock radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphone, and tablet. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Rock radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And we are back. I'm Nick Feeders. My guest is Chris Winchester. And the call-in number here, if you want to ask a question, we're talking about mythicism today, is 714-242-5180. So, Chris, how does Carrier's argument for the non-existence of Jesus start?
Well, he starts out with what Earl DeHardy starts with, and that is, again, Jesus is a purely celestial entity. And he does go a bit further and argues there was a pre-Christian celestial being named Jesus that was called the firstborn Son of God, the celestial image of God, God's agent of creation, and the high priest.
Mm-hmm.
And Carrier emphasizes that these are all attributes given to Jesus in Paul's letters, except for the high priest issue. And Carrier acknowledges that's actually in Hebrews. And he says the fact that you've got a pre-Christian being named Jesus that has all these characteristics, which very closely parallel the Jesus found in Paul's letters, strongly suggests the Christians kind of borrowed this belief and character and modified it for their purposes.
Now, does he have any evidence of it?
Well, he cites Philo of Alexandria during a series of presentations. One of them is actually a presentation he gave to the UNCG atheists in North Carolina earlier this spring. And he's also mentioned Philo's work in his debate with Mark Goodacre on Unbelievable. And interested listeners can go on to basically iTunes and just download that episode for free. I believe it was the December 26th podcast. December 15th, 2012.
I listened to that show also, and I remember hearing that claim and going to Philo's works online and looking vociferously through them, and I could not find that reference anywhere. Did you have any better luck?
Well, in this presentation he gave, he does direct readers to his book, Not the Impossible Faith. And in there at 284, he identifies Philo's work called On the Confusion of Tongues, 14.62 through 63 as the source. And so, fortunately, this source is actually online for free. You can go to earlyjewishwritings.com and just click on it. It's called On the Confusion of Tongues. And the short answer is, you are correct. The name Jesus does not appear in that passage.
What do we have in that passage?
Well, it says in part, quote, I have also heard one of the companions of Moses having uttered such a speech as this, behold, a man whose name is Rise, or the East, depending on how you translate the Greek word here, anatole. And Philo says, he continues, a very novel appellation indeed, if you consider it as spoken of a man who is compounded of body and soul. But if you look upon it as applied to that incorporeal being, who is in no respect different from the divine image, you will then agree that the name of Rise has been given to him with great felicity. For the Father of the universe has caused him to spring up as the eldest son, whom, in another passage, he calls the firstborn. So the name that Philo gives this person is Rise or East, from the Greek word anatole. And he's actually, that phrase, behold a man whose name is Rise or East, comes from Zechariah chapter 6. Supposedly. And Carrier emphasizes that phrase is found in Zechariah 6. However, listen to this again. This is from the same passage. Philo says, I have also heard of the one of the companions of Moses having uttered such a speech as this. So Philo actually attributes this quote to one of Moses' companions, not Zechariah.
Mm-hmm.
So the two main points I would just make here. Number one, Philo calls this being rise or east, not Jesus. And I see no real evidence to indicate Philo was concerned with the context of Zechariah because he identifies it as a quotation coming from one of Moses' companions.
Mm-hmm. And was there something else you were wanting to note about that?
Well, if you look in Zechariah 6 and just read the context of, I'd say, Zechariah chapter 1 up through chapter 6,
mm-hmm.
the person that's called Rise or East throughout that book is actually a different person than the person Carrier would argue is
mm-hmm.
the person under consideration. He says
now,
that...
Mm-hmm. Go on.
Well, he says that Zechariah is referring to a man called Joshua, which
mm-hmm.
in Greek is basically Iesu, which we translate as Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, Joshua is the man who's being described in Zechariah 6.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that assumes that Philo had Zechariah 6 in mind. But if you read that whole context of Zechariah 1 to 6, you find out it's actually not talking about him at all, but it's talking about another man who's called Branch or Priest.
Mm-hmm. Now, we often, when we're trying to interpret another author's work, we try to be as charitable as possible, but it seems awfully difficult in this case. I mean, what do you think is exactly going on that a mistaken reference like this would take place?
I think he's confusing the context of Zechariah 6 with what Philo actually said.
Mm-hmm.
And the character I was mentioning earlier is actually Zerubbabel. And in Zechariah 4:9, he's called Branch or Anatole mm-hmm. in the Greek version of the Hebrew Scriptures.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's go on from this point then. We start about how Carrier said in this debate that this is kind of how Christianity got started. So let's go on from there. Where does Carrier go from here?
Well, from here, he starts to look at Osiris.
Mm-hmm.
And he then points out that like Osiris, Jesus's burial and death and resurrection occurred just below the moon in outer space.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that public stories told about Osiris place him on Earth, and that he, in fact, was buried in a tomb, and people in the time of Plutarch, for example, could go and visit the tomb of Osiris. However, Carrier then says there were other private stories that said Osiris died and rose from the dead in outer space just below the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Earl DeHardy likewise makes this argument in chapter 12 of Jesus, Neither God Nor Man. And I've actually read that book, and I've done a chapter-by-chapter analysis of the first half of it last summer. And I've
mm-hmm.
actually read the ancient source that DeHardy appeals to, and suffice it to say, it's not there.
Would this ancient source be the Ascension of Isaiah?
No, this is a book called On Isis and Osiris.
Oh, okay.
We'll get to the Ascension of Isaiah.
Yeah, I know there already makes it. So, that's about the evidence of the Osiris claim. What do you have with it?
Well, in the presentation that he gave at Greensboro, he basically just says that Osiris died underneath the moon in the heavenly realm, but he doesn't actually cite the ancient source material. I'm just guessing he got it from DeHardy because DeHardy makes the same argument.
And what about DeHardy's source material? Is it accurate or not?
Not that I could tell. It talks about Plutarch is the author there. Plutarch mentions the edge of matter or the outermost areas.
Mm-hmm.
And DeHardy looks at those phrases and concludes it's talking about the area in heaven just below the moon. But if you read the context of that work by Plutarch, it's actually talking about the areas at the extreme edges of the earth. And he identifies this like near the ocean or around the mountains.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And now, I'm going to try to get you the specific passage there.
Okay.
Or at least give you the exact name of the work.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's by Plutarch, and it's called Isis and Osiris.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, then, we move on there. We've got this event happening supposedly in outer space. We've still got a ways to go. What's the next step?
All right. The next step from there is to actually look at another Jewish source called the Revelation of Moses.
Mm-hmm.
It's also called the Life of Adam. And Carrier says that within this source, Adam was believed to have been buried in outer space. So you don't have to go to, say, a pagan source like Plutarch to find someone being buried in outer space. You can actually look at a Jewish source that says the same thing.
Okay. So, what have you found about this claim? Does it hold up?
It does not, unfortunately. It talks about Adam dying and then God asking one of his angels to go collect the body of Adam and bring it back up to the third heaven in paradise. And once it's in paradise, God commands that the body be buried. And so it's buried in paradise in the third heaven. Now, this is very important to really emphasize because the third heaven would not be where the moon or the stars would typically be located within Jewish cosmologies.
Right.
Because
that would be
the
second heaven, wouldn't it?
It would be, well, depending on which text you're looking at, it could be the second heaven or the first heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, it would not even be the first heaven. It would be just right in the atmosphere even, just a little bit lower. And if you read the context, it doesn't mention him being buried under the moon or in outer space. It just says he was buried in paradise, and he was raised into paradise, even to the third heaven.
So what would the first and second heaven be exactly?
Well, there's a lot of variety within the Jewish writings, and basically some Jewish texts would say there are seven levels of heaven. Others would say there are three levels.
Mm-hmm.
Some would go as far to say that there might be even more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to note here, the Revelation of Moses is actually of uncertain date, that we cannot confidently date this to the first century, and especially we can't say this is contemporary with Paul.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it did mention Adam being buried in outer space, you would have no definitive evidence that suggests it was during the time of Paul.
Now, when we talked about there are different interpretations of a first and second heaven, and that could include different ones of a third heaven, do you know of any interpretation of a third heaven that equates it with outer space?
Not that I'm aware of, no. Is typically sometimes linked with paradise. Sometimes paradise is placed in the third heaven. Like even in Paul's writings in 2 Corinthians 12, he talks about being called up to the third heaven, into paradise. But other scholars will even say, well, actually, paradise is different from the third heaven. So some ambiguity there.
But so far it looks like we're still batting zero here with the references. Is it just likely that Carrier has been depending way too much on DeHardy, and DeHardy really isn't the best researcher?
It's possible, but I don't want to say that definitively because, again, I don't know what sources she's actually citing because the book hasn't come out yet.
Okay. So now, what's the next step from here?
Then he moves on to the Pauline letters, and he focuses on Galatians, 1 Corinthians, and basically just correctly notes that these are Pauline letters. There are other letters that are, quote-unquote, not Pauline, even though other scholars would challenge that view. But for the sake of his argument, he just focuses on the letters that everyone agrees were written by Paul.
Right. So what does he say about these letters? Well, before we even get back, what are these letters? Let's just be clear on that.
These are letters written by Paul the Apostle. Most people date them somewhere between 25, 30, or 40 years after the year 33 A.D., and Paul is our earliest source of material, and so he's very highly regarded among scholars because he's actually writing before the Gospels.
So what letters, though, are we talking about exactly?
We're talking about Galatians, 1 Corinthians, Philippians, and depending on who you talk to, Hebrews, but that's debatable.
Mm-hmm. But also included in there, in the genuine Pauline letters, aren't there 2 Corinthians, Romans, 1 Thessalonians, and Philemon?
That's correct.
Okay, but those others aren't relevant for our purposes here, but it is worth knowing that those are universally accepted. So, what do we get from the books that Carrier uses of the New Testament that he accepts?
Well, he focuses on Galatians chapter 1, verses 11 and 12. And then in 1 Corinthians, he looks at the resurrection appearances in chapter 15, verses 1 to 8.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, he looks at 1 Corinthians 11, 23, where it's describing the Lord's Supper.
Mm-hmm.
And he emphasizes that Paul says Jesus is seen only after his death, that he's not said to have appeared before his death.
Uh-huh.
And that also in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul uses the phrase according to the scriptures, which could mean in fulfillment of or we are told by. So he tries to argue from there that Paul got his information about Jesus by looking in the Hebrew scriptures, and then after reading the Hebrew scriptures, he then applied these characteristics to the celestial being named Jesus.
Made
it up from there.
Yeah, this is a celestial being that Paul knew about beforehand, right?
That's right.
Now, is this anything along the lines of, say, A.N. Wilson's idea that Paul invented Christianity, or is it something different?
Maybe not all of Christianity, but he certainly invented certain characteristics usually associated with Jesus. And he says about the Last Supper in 1 Corinthians 11 that this was a vision from Jesus given to Paul. And this means that Paul hallucinated the Last Supper and received teachings from the dead Jesus.
Mm-hmm. And he makes much about the idea of Paul getting information through revelation, right?
Correct. He emphasizes that Scripture and revelation are the only sources of information that Paul ever mentions anyone having.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I've got some questions I've got to ask about that, and some of you listening might have some questions. If you want to ask your own question, it's 714-242-5180. But if you don't call in, I'll have my own questions, and we'll get to those questions when we come back from this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
I can't believe in you today. Oh, I can't hold my
We're talking with Chris Winchester, a friend of mine, about the Christ myth position. My call-in number is 714-242-5180. We're largely focusing on Richard Carrier today. Now, Chris, you've said that, according to Carrier, Paul only got information through revelation and scriptures. But doesn't Galatians 1, which Carrier accepts, even say Paul went and talked to the apostles, namely Peter, James, and John?
That is correct. And it's worth pointing out that even though Paul says that he didn't receive his information from any man in chapter 1, but he did later go see these other apostles in Jerusalem, and he says pretty clearly that they agreed with what he was teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically said that they are all in agreement. And also in 1 Corinthians 15, I think it's verse 11, Paul says that he and the other apostles were making the same proclamation. So on the Christ, on this particular brand of the Christ myth theory, you've got Paul hallucinating the celestial being, and then the other apostles also probably hallucinating the same being.
Because if these people are apostles, they have to be apostles of someone, and Galatians gives you the appearance that they existed prior to Paul. But yeah, if Paul created this, then it would seem Paul would have to come first.
Well, that's a good point to make as well. And Paul even says, I believe in Galatians 1, I'm going to look up the exact phrasing he uses there, but he basically says that he formerly was persecuting the Church of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to get the exact phrase here. You have heard no doubt, this is verse 13, you have heard no doubt of my earlier life in Judaism. I was violently persecuting the Church of God and was trying to destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
And he also mentions in verse 17, I went away at once into Arabia, and afterwards I returned to Damascus. But he did not go to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me. So he explicitly says there were already apostles before him, and there was a movement that was called the Church that predated his joining of that movement.
So what do Carrier and Doherty say that this movement is based on, then, if Paul is the one who came up with everything?
Well, I'm not sure that Carrier and Doherty would say Paul came up with everything. They would probably say that he came up with certain characteristics. But Carrier would say they were also seeing this celestial being called Jesus, and they may have gotten it from Philo, which, again, unfortunately, Philo doesn't mention a being named Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about 1 Corinthians 15. How's that synonymous? Because we've had Gary Habermas and we've had Mike Lacona both on the show, and you know they make quite an emphasis out of 1 Corinthians 15. And what's the traditional view? Rose don't know. What's the traditional view of 1 Corinthians 15?
The traditional view is that in that chapter, Paul is defending the idea of bodily resurrection, because apparently people were concerned about what type of bodies people are going to have when they're raised from the dead. And to make his argument, Paul actually uses Christ's own resurrection from the dead as evidence. And that's in verses 3-8. And most scholars say, at bare minimum, in verses 3-5, Paul's actually reciting an early creed. And so that's very significant, because if that's in fact a creed, this is information that Paul received from earlier sources, which predates
now, I can already hear the skeptic in the audience saying, well, of course, because this is in the Bible, and these are Christian scholars who are saying this, so of course they're going to say this is an early creed so that they can have early testimony to the resurrection accounts. That is the case, isn't it?
It is actually not the case. This is just a general fact granted by even very skeptical scholars. and Gary Habermas actually makes that point in his book, The Risen Jesus and Future Hope. He actually provides extensive quotations from non-Christian scholars who place that information very early.
Yes, Mike Lacona does the same thing in a footnote in his book on the resurrection of Jesus, and includes people like Gerd Ludemann, John Dominic Crossan, and the rest of the Jesus seminar.
That's correct. So it's not just very, very conservative Christians, and it's not even generic Christians that are conceding these points. Yeah.
But this all seems to point to early eyewitness testimony about Jesus appearing before people, including sometimes in large groups. So what does Carrier do with this?
Well, Carrier, he again directs us back to this idea of revelations and Jesus giving revelations through visions. He says, for example, he talks about how Paul is handing on to the Corinthians what he had received. This is verse 3. And if you read 1 Corinthians 11, it talks about Paul receiving revelation from the Lord. And so even though Paul doesn't use that phrase, a revelation from the Lord, we're just expected to know that's the same source. And he says that way it fits with Galatians chapter 1, where Paul says he got his information about Jesus directly from him. But the point that I would just offer in response there is if you go down later to verse 11, which I mentioned earlier here, it says, whether then it was I or they, so we proclaim, and so you have come to believe. So even if we say it's not a creed, you still have to wrestle with the fact that Paul and the other apostles were all teaching the same thing. And these were apostles before him.
Right. But isn't this the same position he used on Mark Goodacre in his debate?
Yes.
And he was saying that 1 Corinthians was all from revelation, but it looks like he's trying to take the evidence and make it fit the theory of what's in Galatians. Is there a better way to interpret what's going on instead?
Well, I mean, I think the fact he doesn't say the phrase from the Lord should at least give us pause and maybe look at other Jewish sources and think, okay, do other Jewish sources use similar terminology? And although I would question how useful they could be, if you look in rabbinic sources, they're typically a little bit later than the New Testament writings. They do use the phrase delivered and received as a way of passing on early oral traditions.
And doesn't Josephus, in fact, tell us that this is the way the Pharisees passed on oral tradition?
That is true. Very good point. He's first century.
And in fact, Paul himself in Philippians says he was a Pharisee.
That's correct. So he would be very familiar with their mode of orally transmitting traditions.
Okay. But how would this fit in with the claim that Paul received his information by revelation? How can it be by revelation and by tradition both?
Well, Carrier again would probably say it couldn't be. It's just revelation. But you could argue that since in verse 11 that the other apostles also were teaching the same message, that maybe they gave Paul their own version of it later on.
Right. What you're saying then is that Paul, suppose, if Paul's talking about, say, his Damascus Road experience, that he knew the gospel beforehand. Since he was persecuting the church, he knew what they believed. And so he's going down to Damascus Road, and then Christ appears, which is certainly a revelation. And that's how he learns, well, I was wrong after all. And then when he goes to see the apostles, he gets a clearer form of a revelation that he can pass on to others. Would that be accurate?
I believe so, yes.
And so, with all these claims that Paul has in 1 Corinthians 15, I mean, so many people claim to have seen Jesus at that point. And Carrier says they're all hallucinations.
Yes.
Okay. Wouldn't that be a bit problematic, especially since there's no evidence of group hallucinations?
Well, it depends, again, on who you're talking to. Some people will say we do have examples of group hallucinations in which people are hypnotized and they're very strongly encouraged to see or hear certain things. But we don't have any evidence from 1 Corinthians 15 that would say that there was, say, the Apostle Peter that was intentionally trying to hypnotize other people and convince them that they saw Jesus. I mean, it's possible, but Paul doesn't say either way. And then people sometimes will appeal to the apparitions of Mary or everyone seeing the sun spinning in the sky at Fatima. But unfortunately, that argument is confusing hallucinations with illusions. Hallucinations are basically coming from within someone's mind. An illusion is a distortion of something seen.
It's kind of like if you go to a magic show and you watch a magician saw someone in two, you're experiencing an illusion.
Right.
There really is a magician doing something up on the stage, but if you start seeing a giant 6-foot-tall pink bunny rabbit following you around everywhere, it's quite likely a hallucination instead.
That's right. And there's a good book you can read about this. It talks about these hypnotically induced group hallucinations. It's called Sensory Deception.
Mm-hmm.
And the same authors do point out, though, that even in that hypnotic state, not all of the participants there had the same hallucination. In fact, some of them didn't hallucinate anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say very early in the book that hallucinations are essentially private experiences, not group experiences.
And how would this also work with the case of James, who was said to be the brother of the Lord?
Well, James, someone could argue that he had a grief vision of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And these are common today. For example, people will see their dead loved ones appearing to them, and they will sometimes think that they're still with them in some spiritual way. But the question becomes, if Jesus appeared to James in that way, well, if James believed that, I should say, the question becomes, would James interpret that as my brother is raised from the dead, or would he say, oh, he's appearing to me, but he's actually already been translated to heaven, and he's just come back to pay me a visit?
Yeah, because N.T. Wright makes the point that they did know those kinds of hallucinations back then, but no one looked at it and said, oh, that means so-and-so was raised from the dead.
Right. And
in
here's
fact,
another...
Go on.
Okay, well, here's an interesting point as well. Let's assume that Paul did, in fact, hallucinate the Last Supper, that he hallucinated the Last Supper and Jesus instituting it. Typically, hallucinations don't come from scratch. They're always based on some prior knowledge or something in the brain of the person to get them going.
So, yeah, because it's not the brain creates new information. The brain kind of organizes information it's already got and puts it out in the wrong way.
Right. So even if you were to say Paul hallucinated it, that in itself wouldn't disprove the idea. In fact, there was a Jesus who instituted the supper, and that somehow Paul had knowledge of it, and from that knowledge had a hallucination of it.
In fact, when we're talking about James, we could even ask the question, he's called the brother of the Lord, and Bart Ehrman makes a lot about this, comment that it's an off-the-cuff remark, and it's talking about someone's brother. So this would be pretty good evidence that there really was a historical Jesus being talked about.
Well, it's interesting reading the responses of mythicists. Different ones give a variety of responses to that. One of the most common responses is, it's just saying James was a member of a brotherhood. And if you read other parts of Paul's letters, he talks about people being brothers of the Lord, or just consistently through the letters even, he'll say brothers, or adelphoi in Greek. And so the fact that James is called brother of the Lord shouldn't be too surprising from the mythicist view. However, and this is a big however, we have no external documentation suggesting that brother of the Lord was used in a title sense. There's nothing in particular that mentions this. Conversely, we do see in the Gospel of Mark, for example, that Jesus really did have a brother named James among other brothers and sisters. And then combine that with Josephus in Book 20 of Antiquities of the Jews. He mentions James, the brother of the so-called Christ. So you've got multiple attestation to the interpretation that most Christians take, and historians for that matter, that James was the literal blood brother of Jesus, even though you don't have any ancient material saying there was a title, the brother of the Lord.
In fact, when we look at the gospel materials, in the gospels, the brothers of Jesus aren't really exactly heroes cheering in the spotlight. They're more embarrassed about Jesus and wouldn't go away. And this lends for historicity, because this isn't the kind of thing the church would want to make up about its leader.
Now, if your own family doesn't believe in you, it's a pretty bad indication for you.
Yes. If we have a state where Jesus' own brothers didn't believe him, you could ask, why should anyone else believe in him?
Right.
Now, do you think, when we're looking at Paul's ideas, or do you think he got any of it by revelation? If so, how could we really tell what was revelation and what wasn't?
Well, I think he did receive some information from revelation. I mean, in 2 Corinthians 12, he mentions having visions and revelations of the Lord.
Right.
And he does, like I said, in Galatians 1, he mentions that he received revelations from Jesus. However, and this is another major point I want to bring up here, just because something occurs in a vision, it doesn't logically necessarily follow you're not actually describing something historical. Or something set on earth. We won't even say historical. We'll just say set on earth. For example, all the way back in the Old Testament in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 1, it says, the vision of Isaiah, son of Amoz, which he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. So just because something's in a vision, it doesn't mean that something is a celestial thing. It could be a vision of a real flesh and blood, concrete, earthly person or thing.
Yeah. Either way, I mean, can we also say that it could just be Kyrios doing some bad translations of it? Some commentators look at the passage about the Lord's Supper and say, Paul's not saying he gets this by a direct revelation, but that the ultimate source of it is from the Lord, not that the Lord personally appeared to him and said, hey, here's what happened.
Yeah, in fact, a lot of scholars, commentators that is, will say exactly that, that ultimately this did come from the Lord, but it came through the venue of the Christians before Paul.
Okay, well, we're going to be digging in even more soon, because we are just about done with our first hour, actually. It's amazing how time's gone by. And in fact, in this next hour, we're going to be trying to do something we haven't really done before, and that's going to be playing clips of Carrier speaking. We're going to see how well it works. If it doesn't, and Chris hasn't written out, he can tell us what he says, but we're going to see if that works. Chris is going to play for us some things that Carrier has said and give us his reply. So we'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
And we're back to the second hour of a Deeper Waters podcast. My name's Nick Peters. My guest this week is Chris Winchester. But if you're listening next week, my guest will be Dr. Robert Gagnon. He's written the book, The Bible and Homosexual Practice. We will be talking about the Bible, homosexuality, probably ideas like DOMA and other such things, and seeing how Christians should respond to the homosexual lobby. It promises to be a quite exciting show. Dr. Gagnon is a very entertaining and humorous fellow, so should have an enjoyable time here. Okay. Now, when we're going back to Carrier's position, you have some clips of Carrier, don't you, Chris?
I have a few clips. Before I get to them, however, I want you to just finish up part of the Pauline evidence that Carrier cites.
Okay, sure.
And so we talked about the revelation aspect of his argument. Then he also mentioned Scripture, and Carrier says that everything Paul knows about Jesus came from Scripture, so therefore Jesus was just a celestial being that was fleshed out, so to speak, by Hebrew biblical material. Now, I would just point out that the fact Paul applies Scripture to something doesn't mean that object or person was not an earthly person or thing. And here's an interesting book called The Jesus Dynasty by James Tabor, who is not an evangelical Christian by any means. Here's what he writes on page 157. Quote, "I am convinced that Jesus most likely began to read certain passages of the Hebrew Scriptures and apply them directly to himself." And so somebody might ask, okay, what led James Tabor to that conclusion? I would say there are two main lines of evidence. The first comes from the general Jewish background of the time and even before Paul and Jesus. Specifically, the Dead Sea Scrolls reveal that other Jews in that time and earlier applied that same scriptures to themselves, to their situation in the wilderness, and to their teacher, who they say initially founded their group.
This would be the Qumran community and the Teacher of Righteousness you're talking about, right?
That's precisely correct. And scholars, regardless of the Jesus myth controversy, they're very, very fascinated by these scrolls, because these scrolls date from the 2nd century before Christ all the way up to the 1st century AD or CE. So it goes very far back, and some of them are actually contemporary with the first century. So it gets a really good window on the Jewish background of the time and just a few centuries before.
Now, these groups, when they talk about prophecy, and it's much the same way in the New Testament, it wasn't that prophecy was necessarily always talking about the future, but that they were interested in finding parallels that were going on. So it's not, for instance, that, say Isaiah makes a prophecy about a virgin birth, and it wasn't the case that Isaiah was necessarily even thinking about Jesus. Chances are you could have been thinking about someone like Hezekiah, for instance. But Matthew looks and says, this is kind of the same thing that's going on with Jesus. We can even say the same thing about, out of Egypt I called my son. Matthew just sees the parallels, and for him that's the prophecy being fulfilled in that sense.
Right. And it's important to point out that not everything from the Dead Sea Scrolls, as you say, is prophetic, that sometimes it applies things to the past, looking back at their own history, sometimes justifying their own conditions. And here's some specific texts from the Dead Sea Scrolls that do this. The first is called Commentary on Nahum. Nahum is a book in the Bible, for those who may not know this. Commentary on Psalms, and Commentary on Habakkuk. And these authors provide no information that they fabricated stuff about themselves or their circumstances simply because they cite scriptures. Rather, their point is, okay, these things have happened, and if we go back to the scriptures, we can see how the scriptures relate to our current circumstances.
Right.
And Timothy Lim, he's a professor of ancient Second Temple Judaism at Edinburgh. He's got his published doctoral thesis called Holy Scripture and the Qumran Commentaries and Pauline Letters.
Mm-hmm.
And he just does an amazing job comparing and contrasting their approaches to the use of scriptures.
So it's not even really the case that these scriptures are being misinterpreted. Matthew, for instance, knew darn well what Hosea was really talking about. He was just seeing there in his own time and using scripture as a way to show this is something similar that's happening in our time. He's not saying Hosea was directly talking about that event.
Correct. And
okay.
Here's another interesting point here. You might rebut this whole discussion by saying, okay, fine, the Dead Sea community treated scriptures that way, but that doesn't mean that Paul would have necessarily done the same practice. Paul could have just taken scriptures and then made things up about Jesus on his own whim. However, just a very cursory survey of his letters shows that Paul indeed, as Timothy Lim argues, treats scripture the same way.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Romans chapter 1, verses 16 to 17, Paul applies Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 4 to Jewish and Greek contemporaries who have faith. For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith. As it is written, the one who is righteous will live by faith. And he does this throughout Romans and his other letters. And so when he quotes from Scripture and talks about other people in his time period and also quotes from Scripture and applies it to Jesus, for consistency, it would make sense to think, well, he's probably applying Scripture to Jesus the same way.
Okay. So, we can see how Carrier has made some mistakes. Are we ready now to look at some of the audio that you've brought here so that we can give a story straight from him?
Certainly. And for that, we're going to look at what he said about a source called the Ascension of Isaiah.
Okay. Now, we can't guarantee how well this is going to work, but we're going to give it a try. So, are you ready?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
This is, as I said, this is from a presentation he gave in Greensboro to the Atheist and Agnostic Society there on campus. And the comment we're going to listen to is 30 minutes into the presentation. And I'm going to get to the exact spot here. Almost there. And we'll start a little bit early, just for context.
Okay.
Here we go.
And various other names. In the Sumerian religion, she also, but she, instead of going through the levels of descending to the levels of heaven, she descended through the levels of hell. And was killed by a death spell by the god of hell, and then her naked body was nailed up, so she was basically crucified, and then some of her helpers came down to resurrect her. It was all part of her plan for this to happen, and she's resurrected, and she ascends back up through the levels of hell, and the story proceeds from there. Now, this is another example of one of those dying and rising god cults that was originally an agricultural cult. We have evidence that possibly this cult has survived in other forms, but we don't have a lot of evidence of that. But the fact that there are so many similarities with this ancient Sumerian tale and and the ascension of Isaiah is enough proof that some version of the story survived, and that whoever wrote the ascension of Isaiah is actually borrowing elements from this descent of Inanna story, this other resurrection God story.
Yeah, Chris, that works perfectly, and if I'm correct, he's talking about Timothy, isn't he?
He's talking about what?
The Sumerian goddess Tammuz.
Possibly. He's talking about Inanna. In other cultures, say Akkadian culture, it's Ishtar. And what he's trying to do is he's trying to show antiquity to the content in the ascension of Isaiah. He's trying to say that same story about Inanna crafted in some way this ascent of Isaiah passage. And to see why that's so important, I'm going to play another clip now where he basically says, this is the type of death the Christ myth theory predicts, namely that demons kill Jesus in the heavenly realm.
Whenever you're ready.
All right.
He gets to earth, he's born to Mary, Pontius Pilate crucified. And Satan and the demons control the outer space region below the moon and are battling each other in outer space there. And their versions of things on earth are also up there in that version of heaven. And then he gets the angel that's bringing him up through this ascension is bringing him up to other levels of heaven. So he goes to the first level, the second level, and so on, all the way to the seventh level of heaven. Just so you know, there's seven levels of heaven. And he brings up, he gets up there, gets a tour of these heavens, and then is taught at the top that God tells him, well, you're going to meet Jesus. Jesus, I'm going to send him down. He's going to defeat the devil and then come back up and be Lord of the universe and so on. And then after God explains what Jesus is going to do, Jesus does it. And Isaiah is there as if he's like looking into the future, seeing Jesus descend and engage in all this activity and ascend and all of that. So this is how this text proceeds. In the earliest redaction of this, which we can reconstruct through a literary analysis and from the fact that we have manuscripts that lack key parts of it, there was no visit to Earth. Jesus doesn't make it to Earth. He appears to die and be killed by the devil in outer space, by the devil and his demons, and is buried and resurrected there and then rises from there. For example, in the main text, the text we have from the Ethiopian church, for example, there's a whole earthly gospel tacked in where he gets to earth, he's born to Mary, Pontius Pilate crucifies him, and the whole deal. But that whole pocket gospel doesn't fit the style of the rest of the text, so we know it's actually an interpolation. Someone inserted that text.
How was that one?
Came in just fine. So what do you think about what was just played?
Unfortunately, it is incorrect.
Unfortunately. Okay. Well, what's incorrect about it? It certainly, I'm sure, to the audience sounded very persuasive. What did Cario get wrong?
In short, the text never says that demons kill Jesus.
Okay.
Or,
what does it say?
Or that his death occurred in heaven. In fact, it actually indicates that the demons were so busy fighting each other that they didn't even notice Jesus going by. It says in chapter 10, verses 30 to 31 of the Ascension of Isaiah, and I saw that when he, Jesus, descended and made himself like the angels of the air, he looked just like one of them. And he gave no password, for each one of them was busy cheating and doing violence to his neighbor. And now here's what's very interesting. Chapter 11, verse 2. And I saw one like a son of man, and he lived with men in the world, and they did not recognize him.
Mm-hmm.
So, two things. First of all, they don't kill him because the angelic powers don't notice him.
Mm-hmm.
And second, 11:2 is actually in the, quote, unredacted version. Carrier had mentioned that there was a later, longer text inserted. This is not from that. This is an earlier redaction. It says that this one like a son of man lived with men in the world.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, Jesus, in fact, did come into our world and lived with men. He didn't just live in a heavenly realm somewhere under the moon.
Now, what is exactly the ascension of Isaiah, since we're talking about it? What is this work?
It's basically in a class of literature called apocalyptic text. It's basically where a heavenly guide, in this case an angel, takes a visionary, in this case it's Isaiah, and it gives him a tour of different layers of heaven and gives him information about Jesus and shows some things going on in heaven and what's going to happen to Jesus. But this source, no one thinks, is actually talking about the real Isaiah. And they regard it as fiction. And it dates, according to the consensus recently, into the 2nd century sometime.
A.D.
And basically, Carrier would say this was dating sometime to the 2nd century or the late 1st century. Although he doesn't give any argumentation for those dates. And it's also worth pointing out that Jonathan Knight, who's a scholar who focuses on this text, he has a book called Disciples of the Beloved One. He basically says that although there are different recensions, there's still sufficient evidence for believing there was an earthly Jesus in focus. And that later on, there was a tendency to make this Jesus character more heavenly. So it's actually the opposite of what Carrier's saying, that as redaction came along, it was just taking him out of Earth history and putting him into an otherworld celestial realm.
In fact, this whole idea would in many ways be repugnant to Jews, wouldn't it, of concept of someone who was seen as deity coming and taking on humanity, right?
Correct.
And of course, this is where the idea of pagan influence comes in, but I think even someone like Craig Evans has written much in Fabricating Jesus to show that Jews resisted pagan ideas staunchly. They wanted nothing to do with them.
I think it also depends, though, on which Jews we're talking about, because Philo of Alexandria, he sort of, I can't give you specific examples right now, but he basically does use part of Greek philosophy, such as Platonic philosophy, and kind of mixes it with Hebrew scripture concepts.
Yes, but it wouldn't be... Go on.
Well, he also talks about how some Jewish groups were engaging in mysteries and having initiations. And that is very, very similar language found in the Greco-Roman mystery religions and initiations. So I think we can say that Jews were definitely embracing portions of Greek culture, but I don't think we can say this shows that all Jews just gave a free pass to pagan culture and said it was wonderful. And especially problematic, I think, to say Paul got his material from mystery religions, such as his Last Supper description in 1 Corinthians 11, because in that same context, he's really just railing against dining with the table of demons. And if you read commentaries on this passage, a lot of them think he's actually alluding to the meals done in the pagan temples. And so it's very likely that he would draw from these things he's criticizing as sources of inspiration.
Right. Well, there's still more to be covered now. You've said that there were three glaring errors that you've seen so far, for instance, in his debate with Mark Grydacre, right?
Correct.
Well, I'd like us to take a look at those, and we'll take a look at them after we get back from this break. We got Chris Winchester here. Our call-in number is 714-242-5180. We'll be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I'm Nick Peters, back here again at the Deeper Waters Podcast. Our call-in number is 714-242-5180. Our guest is Chris Winchester, a good friend of mine. And I would like to remind everyone, since we played the donate clip just now, that yes, we do depend on your donations. For instance, doing this show, I don't get any pay for it whatsoever. It's just a service that I do for you in order to get you equipped. None of my guests receive any income from me either. They're just people who are willing to invest their time, and we should be thankful for them. I encourage you to get any of their books and such whenever you can. Start listening to their shows, things of that sort. But help us out here also, prayerfully, financially. For this show itself, you can make a donation through Deeper Waters. Our blog is at deeperwaters.wordpress.com. We're also working on taking donations through Risen Jesus and most especially through Ratio Christi. In fact, with the Deeper Waters page, if you go there, you can get to subscribe to our newsletter. I just sent one out this past week telling many things that have been going on with our ministry, including how just this week my wife and I celebrated our third anniversary, which Chris was there 3 years ago when we had the wedding. And yes, so far she hasn't cured me, so that's a very good sign. But right now we're talking about the Christ myth theory and Richard Carrier especially, and my guest Chris Winchester says Carrier made at least 3 glaring mistakes in his debate with Mark Goodacre. What's the first one?
Well, a lot of the claims he makes in that debate with Mark Goodacre are some of the same claims we've discussed so far in his presentation he gave to the Greensboro Atheist Organization at the campus there. So there's going to be some overlap. We'll get to the third one soon. But just to wrap up the Ascension of Isaiah's business here.
Okay.
In chapter 9, verses 13 to 14, we read the following, that Jesus will indeed descend in the last days. The Lord will be called Christ after he has descended and become like you in form. And this is the angel telling the human Isaiah, he will become like you in form. And they will think he is flesh and a man. And the prince of that world will stretch out his hand against the Son, and they will hang him on a tree and will kill him, not knowing who he is. Mm. So Carrier would probably say, this right here shows, in fact, it was the devil who killed him. But there are 2 major problems with that interpretation. The first one is, obviously, in context, is saying that Jesus is going to be in the form of a man with flesh, like Isaiah in form. And the second is the business about the prince of that world stretching out his hand against the Son, because if you read earlier in Isaiah, Ascension of Isaiah, chapter 3, verse 11, you read about Beliar, which is another way of referring to Satan. Now, Beliar had taken up his abode in the heart of Manasseh, and the hearts of the princes of Judah and Benjamin, and the king's eunuchs and counselors. Chapter 5, verse 1 says, then Beliar's anger was roused against Isaiah because of these visions, and he took up his abode in Manasseh's heart and sawed Isaiah in two with a wood saw.
Mm-hmm.
So all that to show that when it says that the prince of that world stretches out his hand against the Son, the context seems to imply it would be acting to the agency of other humans.
Mm-hmm.
So just as Beliar motivated certain humans to hurt other humans, it makes sense contextually to think the same thing is going on in the case of Jesus, especially when considering the fact that the same section talks about Jesus taking the form of a man.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, I believe it's on page 124 of Jesus, Neither God Nor Man. Earl DeHardy has something very, very interesting to say there about Ascension of Isaiah and Jesus coming to live with men.
What does he say?
Well, we might need a drum roll while I pull it up here. That is perfect. He talks about this specific passage at the very, very end. It talks about Jesus coming to be with men.
Mm-hmm.
He says this. He's talking about the author here. When he gets to the climax of the Son's descent involving an incarnation on earth, if he knows an entire story containing a wealth of tradition from the Gospels or otherwise, he is hardly likely to reduce it to a single anticlimactic phrase, he dwelt with men, which tells us nothing.
Mm-hmm.
A writer composing a work about Isaiah's vision of the Son's descent could not fail to include something about his life on earth. So basically right here, he's just him dwelling with men, but he's just kind of saying, well, that doesn't matter because it gives us no details.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just a crucial, because it's saying Jesus came to the world and lived with men, which goes against the main thesis that Jesus didn't come to earth to be with men, but just died in the heavenly realm.
Right. Just because we don't have the evidence or claims we don't want doesn't mean we ignore. Just because we don't have the evidence or claims we do want doesn't mean we ignore what we do have.
Right. Exactly.
And this gets into a highly problematic aspect that Mephistus makes so much out of arguments from silence, which, you know, our guest last week had a strong problem with.
Right. And the argument from silence, it cuts both ways. For mm-hmm. example, the brother of the Lord business again about James. I mm-hmm. used an argument from silence and just said that we have no ancient source that talks about brother of the Lord being a title
mm-hmm.
in any Christian group. So that is an argument mm-hmm. from silence, so they can work both ways.
So are we ready to get to the mistakes of the Carey or Goodacre debate?
Sure. We've already discussed the first two, and it's about Philo mentioning a being named Jesus and that a section of Isaiah talks about demons killing Jesus in the lower level of heaven.
Mm-hmm. So what's number three, then?
The third one ties into Philo, and that is okay. that there were Jews before the time of Paul who believed in a celestial being named Jesus, because he uses Philo's text as his evidence for the other claim.
Okay.
So two of them are actually probably just one, but they're wrapped together.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an audio clip of it?
I do. I'm just not sure if I've got the exact minutes and seconds typed into that section.
Okay. Well, we'll just go with what you get, Vanessa, for now. Why is this exactly a glaring error?
Because Philo is simply, number one, he doesn't mention a being named Jesus there. And there is, again, here's another argument from silence. No ancient source mentions a celestial being named Jesus, except for mm-hmm. Paul, if you're taking the mythicist position.
Mm-hmm. Now, you and I have commented before on where, Carrier does seem to have mistaken footnotes and such, and some of these you've even contacted him about, haven't you?
Yes.
Can you give some other examples of such mistakes?
Well, just a general example. I forget which book it was. I think it was one book by John Loftus. Mm-hmm. It was a book chapter in which Carey was arguing against the resurrection of Jesus, and mm-hmm. he was using passages from Herodotus as parallels to testimonies in the Gospels for the mm-hmm. resurrection of Jesus. And he mm-hmm. was citing numerous examples from Herodotus' works of these miraculous and just really bizarre things going on, according to Herodotus, mm-hmm. and emphasizes that everything that Herodotus discusses was rooted in eyewitness testimony, that Herodotus mm-hmm. spoke to the eyewitnesses who then told him these miraculous tales.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I looked up the passages and the histories, which is the work by Herodotus under discussion. And it doesn't say that he acquired all these stories from eyewitnesses. It says that he spoke to the people of different areas, such as I spoke to the Thracians, and they have a story about XYZ.
Mm-hmm.
It would be like someone going to Knoxville. Yes, I went to Knoxville, and the people there have this story about such and such happening.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you emailed Kerry about this, what kind of response did you get?
He basically initiated a series of responses with me. The first time, I think he basically told me the references which he gives in the end notes for that chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, those were the things that led me to email him to start with, because the references he gives don't match up with what he says they say.
Mm-hmm.
And then he also later said that he was confusing Herodotus with Plutarch, that Plutarch is the one who mentions getting stuff from eyewitnesses.
I'm listening to that. I'm thinking, isn't that the kind of stuff you should check on before you write the book?
But I also, I thanked him for the conversation, and he recommended I read a book by a guy who specializes on Herodotus. And so I went to the university library at UNCC and found this book he recommended. And I actually contacted the author, and I don't have the emails in front of me right now, so I can't tell you the book's name or the author, unfortunately. But I emailed the author with these specific examples, and with the exception of one about a specific statue, none of them actually, according to this author, are based in eyewitness testimony.
Mm.
And this is a Herodotus scholar that Carrier directed me to.
You know, I've read something recently also with Carrier talking about the, making a point about how we have more information about Caesar crossing the Rubicon than we do about Jesus. That's a comparison he wanted to make for, I mean, based on what one apologist said, so that's what he went with. And when you start examining the case that Carrier gives, it really isn't that good. I mean, yeah, we all agree Caesar crossed the Rubicon, but the sources that he gives are just as problematic, if not more so. And for instance, how he says that we have Caesar's own words that he crossed the Rubicon when Caesar himself never says it.
Hmm. It's very strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the review I'm talking about is one done by Glenn Peepers, who in fact does the voice for our intro here, and it's a highly fascinating article, but it just shows that Carrier really isn't the most trustworthy one with his sources.
Well, I mean, I'll just reiterate what I said earlier. I'm just singling out Carrier in this case because he makes the best case for a mythicist view. But anybody, even myself, look at the sources for yourself and make sure that what I'm saying is actually what the sources say.
Well, what does Carrier say also we should ask about non-Christian sources that talk about Jesus, such as Tacitus? For instance, Tacitus in the Annals 15.44 talks about Jesus being crucified under Pontius Pilate. So what does Carrier say about that passage?
Well, in his debate with Goodacre and with that presentation I talked about in Greensboro, he doesn't mention Tacitus. Mm-hmm. He basically, at the end of the presentation, presents a slide where he says that there is no other evidence.
Mm-hmm.
He says, let me pull it up here, getting the quote. He basically states that besides this, there is no more evidence for Jesus.
But Carrier has to know about Tacitus, because he's had him in his dialogues with Bart Ehrman over "Did Jesus Exist?"
So, all right, here's the exact quote. The title of the slide is "No Other Evidence." He says everything else is either not independent, they just echo the Gospels, or what Christians said the Gospels say, or is fabricated. So he would probably say about Tacitus, well, he's just repeating what the Christians of his time were saying about Jesus.
You know, the ironic thing is, as was brought out with the Autographs Review, is that the events Tacitus describes are much earlier than the event of, or much later than the event of, say, crossing the Rubicon by Caesar. Caesar crossed the Rubicon before the Gospels took place, and yet Tacitus is reliable there, but he's not when he talks about Christians.
Well, I think it's also important to note that he never identifies the source. He doesn't say that I was speaking to Christians and they told me this. So we have, as historians, we just have to leave it open and say, sure, maybe he got this from a Christian source, maybe he didn't. At the bare minimum, though, this is an external source apart from the New Testament writings that mentioned Christ.
And we can also point out that it's my understanding that Tacitus was very good friends with Pliny, but at the same time, he would not just write some because Pliny said so. He even checked on everything Pliny said.
That's an excellent point.
And Tacitus is said to be the greatest historian of the Romans, if I'm correct.
That's right.
And as a senator, he would also have access to records that would include activities, including those of Pontius Pilate.
That's another good point. And well, go ahead.
Go on. Go on.
All right. Well, I just want to bring it back, if that's okay. I want to go back to the evidence for Jesus again within Paul's writings.
Sure. Sure.
And Carrier acknowledges, for example, that Paul does mention Christ coming from a woman in Galatians chapter 4, verse 4.
Yeah.
And in this same video where he's giving the presentation for the Greensboro atheists, he says that the word Paul uses there, phenomenon, just comes from a word that means made. It doesn't mean born, technically, in all the cases. And that's a very strange word for Paul to use to say Jesus was born of a woman if he was trying to say Jesus was literally born of a woman. And the word there, as I said, is gnomenon, comes from the word ginomai in Greek.
Yeah.
And just for sake of people listening, this is what the verse says. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, in order to redeem those who are under the law, so that we might receive adoption as children. So the word that my version here, New Revised Standard Version, translates as born is coming from the Greek word genomai, which defined means a variety of things, such as to become, to arise, to occur, come into existence, to be created, or be born. In fact, even Earl DeHardy acknowledges that genomai can be utilized in the sense of human birth. And he makes that concession on page 205 of Jesus Neither God Nor Man. And a very respected Greek lexicon, Bauer's Greek Lexicon, or for short, BDAG, it identifies the very first meaning of genomai as, quote, to come into being through process of birth or natural production, be born, be produced. And that's on page 197 of the third edition. So I'm concerned that in this case, Carrier is making a mountain out of a molehill. Because, sure, it can mean just to be made or become, but it does also legitimately mean born. And the Wisdom of Solomon is another source, a Jewish source, that's actually earlier than Paul's writings. And in chapter 7 of that, verses 1 to 4, we read, I too am a mortal, like everyone else. a descendant of the first man formed from the earth. I was modeled in flesh inside a mother's womb, wherefore 10 months in blood I acquired substance. Out of the seed of man, or in Greek, ex spermatos andros, and pleasure, sleep's companion, I too, having been born, genomenos. So this text makes some very interesting points. Number one, it uses genomenos, which also comes from genomai, as I've said, which means, in this context, to be born.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is an example of a Jewish source before Paul even that uses that word to say someone was literally immortal who was born. And I didn't find this source by myself. I actually saw it listed in this Greek lexicon. It just said, yes, Wisdom of Solomon 7:3, be born. And so I looked it up, and that's what I found in context. And then finally, this phrase, out of the seed of man, it's almost identical to what Paul writes in Romans chapter 1, verse 3, which Carrier also talks about in that presentation.
And isn't that passage even said to be creeder?
By some people, yes, it is. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we're going to be coming up for our final session here, on this show. We've got less than 20 minutes left. We'll be back after this break.
It's here, the official Grok Radio mobile app. Listen to your favorite Grok Radio programs on your iPhone, iPad, iPod, Kindle Fire, Android smartphones, and tablets. The best thing is, it's absolutely free. Download it now from the iTunes or Google Play App Store, or get a link at our website, cyiworldwide.com. Grok Radio, Christian radio that doesn't suck.
And I encourage all of you to get the Grok app. And yes, you can listen to Deeper Waters on that app. So, in case you miss any episodes, and let's hope you don't, you can catch up on them that way. Now, we're in our last session here with Chris Winchester. Our call number is 714-242-5180. And one more reminder, next week our guest is Dr. Robert Gagnon, author of the book The Bible and Homosexual Practice. And we'll be talking about, well, the Bible and homosexual practice. So tune in next week. I'm sure it'll be a very controversial and interesting show. And, of course, I don't mind a little bit of controversy. So, now, Chris, where is your case going from here about the evidence for Jesus and Paul?
Basically, I'm just going to stick with Paul because he is the earliest source we have for Jesus. And a lot of mythicists, and Carey in particular, try to use Paul as their guy, saying Paul did not believe in a literal human Jesus, but a celestial Jesus who lived only in the heavens. So that's why I'm focusing solely on Paul as a source.
Okay.
And in Romans 1:3, it says, the gospel concerning his son, who is descended from David, according to the flesh, or literally from the seed of David, spermatos, and that is the exact same word the Wisdom of Solomon uses, from the seed of man, talking about a man literally immortal who is born. And then finally, this phrase, according to the flesh. Earl DeHardy, I don't believe Carrier makes this point in the presentation, but I know DeHardy definitely spends a good deal of time in his book, Jesus Neither God Nor Man, on the phrase kata sarka, which means according to the flesh.
Right.
Because Paul says that Jesus was born according to the flesh. And so, from there, DeHardy tries to argue that phrase can be interpreted in many different ways. And he is correct. If you read Paul's letters, it can have a range of translations. But the question becomes, from the immediate context of what he's writing in a given instance, which meaning is most probable? And so if it says that he was from the seed, spermatos, of David, according to the flesh, the most natural meaning is he was literally physically descended from him. And then if you look in Romans chapter 9, verses 3 and 5, you see Paul saying the following: "For I could wish that I myself were accursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brothers, my kindred according to the flesh, kata sarka. They are Israelites, and to them belong the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the worship, and the promises. To them belong the patriarchs, and from them, according to the flesh, kata sarka, comes the Christ."
Mm-hmm.
So in these three verses, Paul uses that phrase, according to the flesh, to refer to human Jews, and says, according to the flesh comes the Messiah, or the Christ.
Right.
So, in this case, the context clearly means kata sarka is saying literal physical descent.
Mm-hmm. And if this is Creter, then that makes it even earlier. And there are some scholars, as we said, that do say that passage is a Creter statement.
That's right, Romans chapter 1, verse 3, absolutely. And I would just pretty much wrap up by saying, if you just go through the rest of Paul's letters, it says he was born of a woman, he was descended from David, as we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
1 Corinthians 11 says he instituted the Last Supper.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 15 says he was crucified, that he was buried, that he appeared to people after he was killed and buried. And that's basically the outline of the Gospels, even though we're not looking at the Gospels today as evidence.
Right.
And he also mentions a group called the Twelve in 1 Corinthians 15, which there is a group called the Twelve in the Gospels. Now, granted, we can't tell from that verse in 1 Corinthians 15 that we're talking about the 12 disciples, but it does pretty much fit up with it pretty nicely.
Yeah. Well, Chris, it looks like we've got a caller coming in, and I think I recognize this number. Would you like to take a call?
Sure.
Okay. And you are on the air.
Well, I would like to ask you a question about your comment that you made earlier about the emotionalism of a lot of Christ mythers. But before that, I would like to preface that with a quote by noted religious historian Timothy Aldred, who says, "Information should not be received and interpreted under the influence of biasness or favoritism, but rather it must be allowed to sift through your mental refinery where its elements can be seen for exactly what they really are." Seriously.
Yeah.
And my question, you started off briefly discussing the emotionalism of Christ mythers, especially those on the internet, of the Zeitgeist crowd and the Acharya-esque crowd. By the way, I tried to go to her website today, and it appears to be down. Do you think this might have something to do with a strain of fundamentalism within atheism?
Probably, and a lot of the, honestly a lot of, but many of the people who embrace some form of the Christ myth theory come from very fundamentalist Christian backgrounds. I mean, for example, Robert Price, he was a very, very strong Christian before he became a very, very prolific atheist, Christ mither. And a lot of times, I think a lot of quote-unquote deconverted Christians become very strong emotionally fundamentalist atheists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually wrote a review of Robert Price's book, The Reason-Driven Life, and it's available on Amazon, my view is. And that's the exact same kind of thing I was going, because he keeps having all these literalistic interpretations and such showing up throughout. And with these fundamentalist atheists, it's not that their methodology changes, it's just their loyalty changes.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very good point. And just about Robert Price, real briefly, when he read Ehrman's treatment of his argument in his book about Jesus, Robert Price apparently got very upset with it. And he somehow slandered, or maybe it was libel, I don't know if it was in print or on one of his podcasts, but he basically just let Ehrman have it. And Ehrman heard about it And he said at first he didn't think Price had said it, but he investigated and found out he had said some of those things about Ehrman. So it's just an example of even a very prestigious mythicist getting emotional when someone, you know, attacks what they're saying.
Yeah, I think it's got a lot to do with what I had talked about in the show earlier as well, with what I've called the Jesus allergy, where you can't admit there could be any grain of truth whatsoever to the New Testament.
Very true.
Well, our caller is still here. Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
I had something. Well, I'm sure if I think of something, I'll call back or something.
Well, thank you for your call, sir.
All right. Well, we're going to let you go for now, and we'll get back to wrapping up the show then. Okay. Yeah, I think you know who that was.
I have a pretty good idea. He's a good guy.
Yes, he is a very good guy. I think one other thing we could touch on is we've only got a little less than 10 minutes left, but Carrier also tends to go against Acts entirely and just says, just read Pervo. Now, what is Pervo's theory on Acts, and how well accepted is it in the scholarly community?
Well, let's see. Well, in the one book I have read by Pervo, Dating Acts, he puts that book in the 2nd century sometime, early in the 2nd century, the first half of it. And most scholars in the field still put Acts sometime in the late 1st century. But I've come across a few, James Tabor being one of them, who's starting to lean towards a later date for Acts, sometime in the 2nd century. And I believe Paula Fredrickson is leaning towards a 2nd century date for Acts. But by and large, Pervo is still in the minority.
And Pervo's thesis also, from what I've read in Prophet of Delight, is it's kind of, that Acts is kind of a historical fiction. And even if someone dates it to the 2nd century, I don't know how many of them would say it's historical fiction, if any of them. I think it'd be extremely rare.
Could be.
So now, we've only got about 8 minutes left. And where do you think things are going from here? I mean, one thing I've told people is, actually, I think we should give thanks that Richard Carrier and others are out there, because the more they're promoting this Christ myth stuff, the more damage they're really going to do to atheistic thinking. Because they're going to buy into this as if it's the best in scholarship, when it certainly isn't. And when the tide turns, we can kind of corner the intellectual market. What are your thoughts there?
I think that as especially more youth grow up, more into adults, I think we're going to start to see a trend of young adults who think Jesus never existed, mostly because of the internet and, in particular, YouTube. And I think we're going to find these ideas in our universities eventually. And so it's very important for everyone, not just Christians, but everyone, to actually read the ancient sources and try to at least get some basic language terminology under their belts.
Yeah, and what we've talked about here before on the show, especially when we had Jay Warner Wallace on, is that all this danger is really just one click away. You parents out here to consider a scenario: if a young kid of yours, 13 or 14, sitting in their room on their computer, listening to a favorite Christian band on YouTube, and they see on the side related videos such as Why Jesus Never Existed, or The Many Contradictions of the Bible, or something of that sort. All it takes is one click for child's descent into apostasy to start, and the first line of defense is going to be parents who know what they're talking about.
Right.
Now, a great... Also, not only is Ehrman's Did Jesus Exist a good one to read? Yes, I'm actually recommending reading an Ehrman book to make a case for Christianity here. But another great one that you've recommended, in fact, you bought for our partner in crime one time, I think, is Shattering the Christ Myth by J.P. Holding, right?
In all honesty, I'd have to say, and I do respect Ehrman as a scholar, I do, especially his more academic writings, his New Testament textbooks, for example.
Yeah.
But in all honesty, I have to say, after reading both his book on Jesus existing and Shattering the Christ Myth, I'd have to say I thought the latter made a better case as far as identifying the fallacies and even factual errors in the Christ Myth theories. And I cannot recommend this book edited by J.P. Holding enough. And some people might say, well, a lot of the essays written in that book aren't by historians or New Testament scholars. But that's really beside the point, because most of the books put out by Christ mythicists aren't written by scholars or historians either.
And again, just go and check the sources every single time.
Exactly.
So what are some tips you think we should have in mind? Got less than 5 minutes left. What are some tips you think we should have in mind when we encounter Christ mythers?
Well, first option, very first step, I would say, is be very, very nice to them and ask them questions to figure out exactly what kind of Christ mytho they are, because what you don't want to do is start answering objections that they actually don't raise.
Right.
As I said at the very beginning, there is a wide spectrum of Christ mythicism, so you've got to figure out what kind of Christ mythicist you're talking to. And after that, I would ask them about historical methods. In other words, how do we know, say, Hanina ben Dosa or Hillel, other Jewish prophetic and rabbinic figures from antiquity, existed? And then, after you answer that question, say, how does the evidence for these people stack up to the evidence for the Jewish Jesus?
Because it usually turns out... Go on.
Well, that using that approach, basically, it helps someone be logically consistent when they're examining the evidence for Jesus compared to other people.
Usually I find in most interactions that the Bible, as a work of evidence, is given a totally different standard than any other work. And if we applied the same rules to the Bible that we did to ancient history outside the Bible, we wouldn't know hardly anything about ancient history.
Correct. And like Hanina and Hillel, the only sources we have about them are from their later disciples. And that would be the equivalent of just Christians preserving our Gospels about Jesus.
Yeah. And concerning how we talked about Caesar earlier in Tacitus, even the Caesar that sat on the throne in the time of Jesus in Tacitus, that's about 80 years later. But that's still considered a reliable source. And as Habermas has said, our biographies of Alexander the Great don't show up until 400 years later, and that's considered reliable.
Well, I mean, I think some people would object that we do have an inscription that mentions Alexander the King that would date to his time, and they would acknowledge that some biographies about Alexander the Great are better than others. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I would just, I'll just end with this point. Sometimes people will say, well, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, that you can't compare Jesus, a miracle worker, to someone like other rabbis, because you need to have extraordinary evidence for the claim that Jesus existed. I would just say this. We do have extraordinary evidence. If you go through that practice of comparing the evidence for each person, you'll realize, wow, we do have extraordinary evidence for Jesus.
And I would like to remind you, some of my listeners, if the concern is with miracles, in 2 weeks we got Craig Keener coming on here to talk about miracles, that'll take care of a lot of us. Chris, we got less than 90 seconds left. How can people find you if they want to know more?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have a website or a blog or a book yet, but in the next few years, perhaps I'll have something up.
Well, okay. And to your fan, I can say if you go to my blog site, for instance, and if you leave a message, say, hey, pass this on to Chris, I'll make sure that he gets it, okay?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me on the program today.
No problem. Next week, we have Dr. Robert Gagnon showing up here. We're going to be talking about homosexuality, so get set to let all your friends know. And yes, I am being prepared to be called a homophobe and a bigot and intolerant endlessly. It's okay. I've gotten used to it. But I hope you'll tune in next week
And for now, I'm Nick Peters, signing off.